Hello and welcome to this next episode of the Lost Baggage Podcast. I am your host, Brian Whitmer, joined today by my kindred spirit, my good buddy, Andrew Somps. Andrew, how are you today? Well, how's it going?
Hey, Brian, I'm pretty good. You know, I'm hanging out, talking to you in my bathrobe. Woke up a little while ago, drinking some coffee, and sun's shining, so can't complain too much.
I thought you were wearing a flannel. I thought you were a little more casual. I didn't know how long that went down there.
It goes down all the way. It's a full bathrobe.
That's a perfect Zoom bathrobe, as it is flannel pattern. Like, you could look like you're wearing a flannel, you know, from the chest up.
I've worn this in work meetings, so it works.
that works. So in your work, I'm in Prague. You're in Colorado.
In Boulder.
Yeah, I have very fond memories of Pearl Street. That's a fun city. We'll get to kind of where you are now. We can kind of start out like where did you kick off? You're an East Coast guy to start off.
Yeah.
Bring me up to speed. I don't honestly know all the details of you before when we first played together. Go ahead.
Sure. So I grew up in Connecticut. I was born in California and then moved to Connecticut when I was about 7 or 8. Second grader, and my parents wanted me to get involved in a sport. They just figured, why not lacrosse? It was kind of random in their selection. And I remember pretty vividly pulling up to tryouts in our big, clunky green Suburban. And I remember cowering, like, just in the fetal position in the back of the Suburban, because I didn't want to go to tryouts. I felt like I was being forced to go to these tryouts. And then it took the coach at the time, his name was Bruce Cohen, it took Bruce to come out into the parking lot and literally pull me out of the car and say, come on, get in there. So it was, you know, a beginning by force. I did not want to play. I think it was less of being intimidated by the sport and much more being intimidated by just being the new kid, you know? And so that was really the sort of the origin of my lacrosse career. And then it really took off from there. I was always a ball kid. My first word was bah. And so I have always been oriented towards catching and just sort of the hand-eye sports and games. And so lacrosse really just, like, it clicked with me right away. There was, it wasn't long until I was really sort of just practicing every day for multiple hours in the backyard, whether that was on the wall ball or literally just like throwing ground balls to myself. And then it's kind of just flowered from there. Played all the way through middle school and high school. And then finally, I sort of knew pretty early on that I wanted to play in college. I don't know. Is that kind of the beginning that you're looking for?
Yeah, actually, I really love the imagery of you being dragged out of. I'm picturing like one of those '90s like Suburbans, like, you know, like the big steel doors and like the hearse back doors, right? I'm imagining like one of these long, probably the Forest Green model, right? Not the Kelly model. And a cowering Forest blonde Green. Child in the back. Yeah, like. I was crying.
I was audible. I was tears were streaming down my face. There was nowhere I'd least rather be. Like, I did not want to be. I mean, that wasn't an English sentence, but it was terrible.
Yeah. I see kids frequently and I speak English and they don't always speak English. So therefore I'm even worse, right? Like, I'm this strange creature from who knows where that they can't communicate with. And like, I'm glad your parents allowed you to be ripped out of the Suburban, because a lot of these parents oh no, he doesn't want to go. I'm like, I can see that, you know, but let me literally cut the umbilical cord for you, throw a helmet on your kid, and he's going to have a blast. Like, I'm glad your parents allowed you to be ripped out of a Suburban when you were a child.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, it was a tender ripping out by this coach of mine, who actually became a kind of mentor to me. He really sort of fostered my development and growth, not only in lacrosse, but also in sort of the larger sphere of my becoming. I can't say enough. I mean, because especially if you're new in a town or you are new, certainly to the sport, there's going to be that initial shyness that really can be overwhelming, but you do a lot of times need that sort of push or that pull in my case,
absolutely,
to get you going.
And that's not just, you know, lacrosse or any other sport. That's just like a social, it's a big step of, you know, childhood development. Like, I'm afraid of doing this because I'm not part of it. Therefore I need to get over that, you know, or you'll never, like, you know, go talk to a girl, or you'll never, like, you know, apply for college or get a job. Like, you know, these are, you know, real life applications that unfortunately happen to 5 and 6 year olds, you know, like it needs to happen. I don't relish that part of it, but it's, you know, we talk about life lessons in sports. It doesn't start when you're like 15, you know, years old. It starts, you know, day one, literally.
Yeah.
And then,
no, and I mean, that's kind of been a theme throughout my life. I've always needed to be pushed or pulled or like sort of strongly invited into something, because I do still have that initial fear towards change, towards something that's new. You know, even I remember, and this is kind of embarrassing, but I remember crying when I was 18 years old, getting dropped off for college and being like, what am I doing? You know, and what kind of mistake have I made shipping myself from the comfort of my home and to this new foreign place? And, you know, all it took was my teammates sort of rallying around me and indoctrinating me into the ways of college lacrosse before I totally forgot that I was missing home or, you know, feeling that loss.
Yeah, I don't remember. I definitely didn't cry, but I do remember was that a good idea? Like, you know, you don't get, you have enough time as it's that first day. It's like, I have enough time to consider whether that was a bad idea or a good idea. However, I am now living with the consequence. Like, you know, I'm here now. Like, it's time to do it. Time to live the college life. But you went to Drew University and you had a pretty successful career. I mean, says you, I guess. I didn't look it up. Like,
says me, yeah. I'm the main source of that claim there.
I've never run anywhere else.
Drew was a fantastic experience for me. Wanted to go, I think like yourself, you wanted to go to a college or a program that you could sort of be impactful right away. Is that right?
Oh no, I was horrible. I was a 4-year bench guy. I'm going to draw that parallel, you know, the contrast later. You had a very successful college career and wound up going to that next step, and, you know, where we played together. I had I was one of the least impactful players for 4 years straight. Like, and if it had been 6 years, it probably would have been 6 years straight. Like, so tell me what it's like to be good. Tell me what it's like to be like a useful player on a team.
Well, you know, I wish I could say that my 4 years there were like, you know, I was impactful all 4 years, but I can't say that. In fact, my career sort of undulated between being really good and kind of really bad. It started off with a bang. I was the lead scorer on my team freshman year. I think I walked away that season with something like 40 points. I outscored the rest of the team by 10 points or so. As a freshman, I was feeling pretty jazzed about my contribution. And like, oh, you know, as a freshman, you're like, oh, okay, now if that was freshman year, then, you know, watch out. And so I was feeling not cocky, but sort of solidified in the choice that I'd made to come here and being a part of this team. And sophomore year was similar. I think I came in second in points. And then junior year, I really fell off. And I attribute that mostly to my time studying abroad in Paris. I went away for the fall semester, and then so I missed fall ball. I missed sort of the fraternizing that teams do in the fall before the season starts. And then when I came back in January, I was kind of like, I don't know, I had spent the semester in Paris not abusing my body, but definitely not exercising like I would have in college. You know, I drank a lot of wine, I ate a lot of bread and cheese, I smoked a couple cigarettes here and there. So, you know, I was not the epitome of a college athlete upon returning. And then it really showed. You know, I think I actually was sort of benched for a period of the season. I didn't play. I certainly didn't start my junior year. And that was terrible for me. I mean, that was like a real cut to my ego in a lot of ways. You know, it was confusing for me too, because I was like, oh, how were you so good the first 2 years? And what, now you just suck? And now you can't catch a pass. You can't score a goal. And I was also, I think part of the reason why, and this speaks to the sort of overall atmosphere of being a part of a team. I had chosen to live alone, like in a one bedroom little, what do you call those in college? Just a
studio, like a
studio, you know? So sure. I wasn't living with the team, and the rest of the team was living with each other. And I think that had, you know, subtle implications on my performance, really. So that was junior year. And then senior year, I kind of returned with a vengeance, but I also came into some issues with particularly my anxiety and my sleep. And those two sort of were interwoven with one another. But my senior year, I got a job at an investment bank. So I kind of had done that. Like I got that out of the way. And, you know, I had a plan right after college to go and work for this bank. And at first I was really jazzed about it and happy that I had done that and sort of could see success for myself in the future. And I felt good. But then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, but I started getting really anxious. I remember walking down the path to class one day and just feeling like this ugly sort of churning in my stomach. And I was so unrecognizable to me. It was like just sort of a demonic force that seemed like it was overtaking my body. And it ruined my sleep. It made me nervous to play. And so while I still maintained a certain level of, I was still an impactful player my senior year, I think my sleep really took toll on my performance because I was so in my head in a lot of ways about what I was going through off the field. Yeah, you probably didn't know that. I was a real head case.
Well, I know that. You always mandated that you had. I mean, we've lived together, and you know, I know that you need to have the sound of a fan while you sleep, which drove me up a wall. I hate that noise. But I'm a silent sleeper. So I actually did not remember that. For years, I have now unremembered that you need to hear the sound of a fan while you sleep. But I just remembered that because you said that.
Well, you know, I'm a weirdo. I have some weird quirks, but I will say you are a silent sleeper until you are not, which typically involves, you know, maybe a couple pints and then you go to bed and then it's a snore fest.
Oh yeah.
I can't turn my sleep fan up loud enough to drown out the sound of your snores.
So I've had some medical, some back problems the past few years, and it ended up, I phased out alcohol like completely for a little while. And this, like, it's a very proven fact that I do not snore whatsoever with sans alcohol. No beers, no wine, no, there's, I'm silent. I am a perfectly quiet sleeper. So yeah, we did, that mystery is no more.
Did I ever tell you that story or maybe I didn't, for good reason probably, but when we were in New Zealand and, we were, I think it was Rotorua, it must've been, and we had gone out and then came back and it was late and you fell asleep pretty quickly and then started to snore really loud. And I couldn't sleep. I couldn't just sort of fall into a rhythm because of your, like the sound of your snoring was really sort of unrhythmical. And so what I did is I took a pillow I took a pillow and I sort of slowly pressed it upon your face. So as to not suffocate you per se, but to certainly
discourage.
Yeah. So maybe your dreams would tell you like, oh, I'm drowning. I don't know. I'm going to wake up and stop doing that. And it worked, you know, you stopped snoring and then I was able to fall asleep. So,
I will counter that New Zealand story with the New Zealand story that, we were with Sam, who I, you know, ended up living with Sam the year that you moved out to Park City. We're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We've got to kind of get back to Australia here in a second, but, we were at that bar in Queenstown and I was getting a little, you know, tipsy and Sam had had her drinks and I was like, all right, look, this Andrew guy I'm with, like, probably known you about 2-3 months at this point in time, maybe 4 months maximum. I was like, when he drinks, he's a runner. Like, we gotta like kill this guy now and send him home in a taxi so that we can continue and having, you know, a fun night without worrying about this guy like bolting on us. Cause he doesn't know where we are. You know, we're new to this town. So, we ordered whatever it was from the bar. And I just remember there was 2 or 3 shots of whatever it was each. And I was like, all right, Andrew, we'll take these. And then sure enough, like 15 minutes later, you're like, can you call me a cab? And we got rid of you right away. That was in your best interest though.
I think so. Yeah. And it wasn't, no, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that caretaking. Wasn't there something with a passport too? Did I leave a passport?
You left it on the bar. So like we sent you home in a taxi, you found your way back to the bar and we had to send you back home in another taxi or something like that. Or you left your passport in the taxi or something. I know that there was a piece of that, but I also, did consume those beverages with you and not everything is as crystal clear as we might like to believe.
Yeah, that's the tough thing with memories of that involve alcohol. They're just not quite as crystal as you'd like them to be.
As they once were. So that was in New Zealand. That was like a bi-week trip, right? But we were originally in the country of Australia. So start with your investment banking and come to Jesus moment. And how did you get to Australia?
Sure. Yeah. So, if you'll remember from a few minutes ago when I was saying I started to experience some real anxiety that I'd never felt before senior year of college in the spring, and that continued throughout the rest of the year and then also into the summer and obviously into the job, and that my lack of or my sleep problems continued and really sort of got worse as the summer continued and as I started to work more and more for this bank, this new job. And then, you know, and so it was a very confusing time for me. I didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, on a surface level, I knew what I was doing. I knew that I was working for a bank, that I was making a paycheck, that I was living at home, but I was very disoriented. Like I didn't feel good in my body. And I was drinking and, I was partying, as you know, young people do. But it just didn't feel good. It felt like sort of meaningless in a lot of ways. And finally, I sort of started looking for ways out. And this Australia opportunity landed on my lap. Someone was doing something similar in England. I had a friend who did exactly what we did, but in England. And so I started looking into it. And Australia, I was like, oh, Australia sounds really cool. You know, I didn't know much about it other than it was really, really far away. It was good weather, beaches. And that was the beginning. And then, you know, a few months later, I just quit. I just said, I'm done. It's sort of out of the blue to my bosses. And they were like, what? Where is this coming from? So it was very sort of, it probably felt impulsive to them. But to me, I had been percolating on this for a while. And so, yeah, my desire or my choice to go to Australia was both due to the promise that it held for lacrosse. Like I knew that being able to play lacrosse that was at least meaningful to me in some way. But then it was also sort of an escape. Like my life was not making sense to me at home. And I felt sort of in a way like, oh, I have nothing to lose. I'm just going to start over. You know, that was the sort of mentality that I think I was working with. And that mentality was colored by a lot of anxiety and sort of panic. But it was a desire to escape in a lot of ways, my sleep problems, to escape the drudgery of driving to work every day for, you know, 50 minutes in traffic. And then
how did you get hooked up with where'd you find Charles Manning? Because I know where I found Charles Manning, but where'd you find Charles Manning?
A coach of mine, another youth coach, his name is Fran Shields. Fran is has been the athletic director at Connecticut College. And he did what I did or what we did 40 years ago. And so he was an imported player from the States to the Woodville Lacrosse Club. And so he and Charles were very connected and close, and they still have a friendship. And so Fran put me in touch with Charles and just via email. And that's how that relationship started. So it was Charles who really sort of dared me to come in a lot of ways, sort of started to paint the picture for me early on. Because at first I had no idea what it was going to look like. I didn't know where I was going to live, how I was going to support myself. And Charles was the one who sort of put the pieces in place, you know. So he was an integral part in the reason why I also ultimately showed up.
I mean, I spoke to Charles for about 5 minutes. I was sitting next to, I've said this story on this podcast before, but I was watching the 2014 World Championships in Denver. And like, I honestly remember Paul Rabil taking a dive and someone like questioning what the call was and like, what was that call? I'm like, oh, I think it was a push. And you know, the guy who asked the question was Charles. And we started talking literally just because he asked the question. I turned around and told him what the answer was. And we started talking and he's like, well, what are where are you from? Like, what do you do for a living? And he's like, come to Australia next year. I'm like, okay, done. Like I had just gone to Prague for the first time. Like I was kind of I was in between jobs. I was laid off. I finally had like a summer to myself. I just worked this bizarre security gig in South Park, Colorado. I was like just riding the snake. And, and I also had that, I had found my escape already. Like moving to Utah was my escape from the quote unquote drudgery and whatever. I was washing dishes before. I wasn't working for an investment banker. I was a couple months ahead of you with the escapist, theory, and I was just riding that wave, and I was just like, yes, I will go to Australia. Like Charles had me sold in about 10, not even 10 minutes, two sentences, give me your email, talk to you next week. I'll see you in Australia next spring. That was awesome. What was your day job? I know I read electric meters. So for those listening, they don't pay you to play lacrosse in Australia. it's not that sweet of a gig, but they do hook you up with a family. I live with the Davidsons, live with the Southwells the whole time, part of the time. I don't remember, but you get a day job. My day jobs were reading electric meters on houses and washing dishes at Chris Manning's restaurant, which I love that job. You read electric meters for like, I heard like 2 weeks and quit.
Yep. Yeah. I did. Yep. Quit right away. wasn't for me, for a lot of reasons. Primary of which was probably my brain couldn't, for whatever reason, grasp that little machine that you held. And I know it was the easiest thing in the world, but it was the reading the dials, like the mechanical dials. I couldn't do that. I just wasn't like quick at it. And there were also dogs and spiders and
yeah, you had to read them. Like the first dial went counterclockwise, and then the second dial was clockwise, and then the third was counter, fourth was regular clockwise, and it was difficult to read them. I do remember that now. And yeah, every box you opened had a gigantic spider in there, and before you got to the box, there was a dog that was trying to bite you. I actually learned how to whistle in Australia because I walked around the blocks for like months going until I could eventually whistle so that I was if there was a dog, I would find out about it. I learned to whistle in Australia because I was sick of getting bit by dogs.
Sure. Yeah, no, it was, I just was like, I'm putting way too much effort and psychic energy into like, how am I going to avoid getting bitten? And I was just, sort of done with it. And then I found a gig, at a local bakery. I was a baker's boy. It was owned actually by Aaron Faneco's family. I forget the name of it now, but I worked there old people would come in and get their hot cross buns, and I would check them out. It was really, really sweet. Like, it was simple. It was 5 hours a day for, I don't know, four days a week or something. And then you play lacrosse and went to the beach. It was pretty idyllic, the lifestyle that you are afforded over there. And I'm sure you'd agree that it was really sort of enchanting in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, the pay rate, it was just amazing to me. I was coming off a park, my first Park City, or I guess my second Park City season, working like a bajillion hours a week and, making good money, but like you had to put the hours in. Here it was like, show up for a couple hours and you'll get way more money than you ever thought way more than you deserve.
I think it was awesome. I think the minimum wage was what, $23 an hour?
I think it was, the minimum was 23, but everyone got higher than that. And I remember it was $26 an hour to wash dishes. And on Sunday, Sundays bumped it up. And at night on Sundays bumped it up. So I was actually doubled it. I was making $52 Australian per hour to wash dishes for like 4 hours. And like Chris Manning, like, the chef didn't care if I actually washed the dishes. Like, he would just like give me like a $40 meal, and like he just wanted to talk about lacrosse. Like, that was the best job ever. And just playing there, like, so referencing it, you scored a lot of points in college, throughout your tumultuous career. I scored very few points in college, and this was my I guess, redemption season. This was where I got to feel like, I was a contributor on this team, because, the roster sizes, each week they capped the roster. Like, the state league team had 15 guys, and to play four times 20-minute running quarters, international rules game. Like, everyone was dead tired after that. And I loved that opportunity. Like, if you had a bad game, the team lost. If you had a great game, your team had a chance of, you know, winning. Like everyone, what everyone needed to have a great game. I loved it was my favorite season of my life.
Yeah. And I remember you, I mean, you were such an important player on both ends of the field. You were like the transition player from defense to offense in most cases. And yeah, you did score a lot of goals that season.
Yeah, that was new for me. like I scored a bunch of goals in high school, but who cares? Like, you know, you score a bunch of goals against bad high school teams. Like it's whatever, but these were like meaningful goals, you know, on the other side of the planet. And I don't think I've ever played a better season of lacrosse. Like, you know, without pumping my own tires like that, I got good in Australia. I got better in Australia.
You really did. And so, I mean, our roles kind of like were reversed. You know, I didn't score a lot. I contributed in ways, but they certainly didn't show up on a scoreboard as much as I would have liked them to. but it was such a blast of a season. I mean, just the camaraderie was so tight and good, and having that little clubhouse, right, you know, that we went to every day for practice and went to after games, that was such an incredible experience, really.
I think the clubhouse is the coolest part. Like, you know, sports around the world have clubs that have clubhouses. You know, after your game, you go to the clubhouse, you have a meal and a beer, and everyone has a social engagement, like a social interaction. You know, after your game in college, like you tailgate for two beers and then like you go your separate ways. Like this was to me a more meaningful, like you, all the teams from, you know, U8s to U11s and girls, boys, men, women, like, you know, first tier, second, third tier men, like everyone says how they did that day. And like it was an awesome, the room had like 100 people in it every time. It was awesome.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I forgot how ritualized that post game show was, because it was the same after every game. You know, you read the top players from each of the levels. You had a meal, like you said, you had a beer, everyone socialized. It really just felt like such a solid community. And no matter if you contributed a lot or contributed a little, like you were part of the family. And for us imports, you know, we were welcomed with open arms in such a beautiful way, I think. You know, they really know how to do it.
And you had, you know, Lyndon, the Southwell family, like, you know, was the mafia behind the club, and the Southwells and Henry, they took great care of me, and, you know, hanging out with Jimmy, who was also an American, who was, you know, down there like kind of long term. It was a really just an interesting mix, you know, like everyone was coming from a different place, but, you know, they were all in the same place, you know, on a given evening. I remember hating going downtown. I didn't like going out in Adelaide. I just wanted to drink beers at the clubhouse, like with those people. I hated going to clubs.
Yeah, no, the club scene was not for me either, although I will say I did indulge from time to time.
Yeah, totally, for about 15 minutes, and then you just book it.
Yeah, I had a bit of a touch-and-go relationship with outings. It's like, okay, I've seen what this is about, and now I will leave.
Yes.
But, yeah, no, I agree. I think just being at the clubhouse was so much easier. You didn't have to think about, you know, everything that it entails when you go out, taxis, money, you know, navigating a new city. It was just so much more comfortable, and you felt like you're home at the clubhouse.
Did the young kids ever drag you to the Rammy?
Oh, geez, yes.
I never did it. I was like 25 at that time, and yeah. I had been to terrible bars full of 17-year-olds before. Like I'm good. I never went.
I did go, and it was because it was really close to the South Wells, so you could walk there from the South Wells. I don't have many fond memories there.
we'll move on from that one. I guess we'll leave Australia even then. So I went back to Park City. I left right before the winter season. Like, I pretty much went home, saw my family, surprised everyone for Thanksgiving. Like, hey, I'm back from the other side of the world. And then just booked it right out to Utah. I caught the tail end of like a Christmas light season, and then straight into the valet gig. And that was the year that you came out. So it was me, Sam, who we had met in New Zealand. Who else was there? Parker was in there, and then Pete. Pete, and from Brisbane. And so like we were living four people in a two bedroom apartment. And then, there was a female staying in the house as well. And then you three showed up. So we had eight people living in a two bedroom. Tell us how you got out there.
It was you. You were the driving force behind that move.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I got home from Australia in December. And then at that point, I did not know what I wanted to do next. I knew I didn't want to go back to any kind of desk job. And you and I were still in communication, and we had obviously become close friends over the year. And so I reached out to you, and I knew you had this Park City thing, and the West had always called to me in a lot of ways. I grew up in California. My sister had lived in Colorado, so I was very interested in going out there. And you said, "Yeah, you should come out here, and I can get you a job, or I can at least put you in contact with the people who might get you a job, and you can ski." So I think I was sort of entertaining this imagination of continuing what my life was like in Australia, which was generally carefree, fun, action-oriented, sports-oriented, you know? And so when you said you should come out here, I sort of jumped on that and said, sure, let's do it, you know? I sort of surrendered to the opportunity or the invitation
invited two buddies, yeah.
Yeah, invited two of my close friends. And so we got out there, James and Will and myself, and we stayed in your closet. We all slept in a walk-in closet.
To better describe that apartment, it was the nicest place I've ever lived. The previous year I lived there with one person, and you know, we each had our own bedroom. The second year we packed it full of people to make it cheaper. It was on top of a mountain overseeing like the south side of the valley. Like, it was beautiful. Moose would run around up there. Like, it was beautiful. And we could totally pack in quite a few people in there. And you brought two other to this day I don't remember you telling me until like that you were bringing two other people. And I was like, oh, okay, great. One was a stud, one was a dud. One brought a knife on the plane and has criminal charges brought against him. And James also came out there, and James is an all-star beauty. Like, is he still out there?
No, he's in New Hampshire now. He's a painter. He's a full-time painter now.
Art.
So he does canvas art, canvas paintings.
That is his full-time job.
That's what he does. Yeah, primarily.
That's amazing. I'm glad that year he got the job like as like a maintenance guy or something at the Hyatt. And, yeah, you know, we were both working there as valets, and he would just walk around and you know, like bang stuff with a wrench and it's like, oh, it's fixed. Or like, didn't actually do anything. Well, I don't think he did very much. I shouldn't say he didn't do anything, but he just wanted to do yoga, ski and, or snowboard and paint.
That's it. And I think that's pretty much what he still does. So
I purchased one of his paintings, two or three years ago. I had like a couple bucks and I was like, I would like to support him. And I actually bought one of the ones he was working on while we lived together, second year. Cause I liked it and I, you know, gave it to my parents or whatever.
Nice.
But yet that first year, you know, you guys kind of survived in our compound of a loft there. I remember the parties there were pretty entertaining. But the next year we moved into that, that one bedroom and that was tight.
That was tight. And that me and James always laugh because that was such a ridiculous living situation. That was so crazy what we did for the entire winter. I mean, yeah, James and I slept on the floor for 6 months. And the only way we did that, well, I should say we smoked, we took a lot of edibles. We took a lot of marijuana gummies to get through that. And we watched a lot of Bob Ross painting on the television. And then he and I would just sort of fall asleep on the floor. And then you had the bed in the bedroom because your schedule is just so much more sort of rapidly paced as opposed to ours, which was slower. And so, you know, just it just made sense that you got the room because you were not there as much during the day.
I remember I worked two full-time jobs. I was doing 16-hour days, 8 days a week, whatever it was. And, you know, I was financially rewarded by doing that. However, I would, you know, come home at, you know, whatever time it was. Sometimes I would even stay late after my shift was over just to finish things up and try to squeeze a couple more, you know, dimes out of the job. And I would usually drink one beer on the way home and one beer at that altitude. We were living on the mountain. So I could walk 5 minutes down the road into our place, which was on the ski resort. And I remember I'd buzz by the time I got home and there's these two goofy little hippies on the floor, giggling and watching Bob Ross paintings. And I'm just like, all right, I got to get up in 5 hours. I can't have any.
Good night, gentlemen.
Yeah. See ya. I was like, what am I doing out here?
Yeah. That was such an interesting time.
But valet work. I mean, I tell everyone out here, I'm like, it was the craziest job I've ever. I've never been so naturally good at something. I loved it. Did you love it? I loved it.
I didn't love it. I think it was, I did catch myself getting into a rhythm now and then, you know, you sort of, and once you got good at it and you kind of knew what to do, I think it was more enjoyable, but for me, at least in the beginning, I was kind of really awkward with it and didn't know.
Did you crash a car the first week or something? Was that you?
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. Crashed a big old truck. rammed it right into a concrete pillar. smashed some taillights. Yeah. And I should have quit then. I should have been like, all right, this isn't for me. But thanks to some bosses who I think were just figured, well, whatever, you know, they just sort of looked the other way and said, all right, you can, just don't do it again.
Were you at the, so other people crash car? I never crashed car. I crashed one car my first year. I never reported crashing any other cars. Were you at the Grand Summit when that there's this new guy and he crashed a car and you'd be drug tested when you crashed cars? And I was always clean because, you know, I was terrified of, you know, I'm just a good old boy, you know, I'm not getting in trouble with that stuff anyway, you know. I didn't want to get in trouble, so I was clean for these jobs. And so the guy's like, oh man, what am I gonna do? I'm like, hey, you know, on the back of that toilet in there, there's a Gatorade bottle full of urine, and I bet it's clean. You know, I'm not saying I peed in the bottle for him, but I did. And sure, you know, so he dumps, you know, uses it. However, he passes the drug test, whatever. And then I go home because I get let off early, you know, for the only time ever. And I wake up in the morning. I got like 500 missed calls, and I'm like, what happened? And they're like, oh yeah, like he crashed a second car later on that night, and they said like, oh, just take another drug test. And he said, I quit. Like, I wasn't around to, you know, pee in the bottle for him. So he quit on the spot.
That is just tragic. That is, I mean, two cars in one night. And yeah.
I enjoyed that job.
Yeah. You know, it was for a mountain job. I can't think of something better, you know, that paid you decently or sometimes really well, and also allowed you to ski on one of the most sort of epic mountains in the country. You know, Canyons Resort is incredible.
Yeah, wonderful choice of wording there. Very epic. On brand.
Epic, yeah. Yeah. Epic, yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
So additional place, we've also, you know, you follow... There was the one year did you follow me from we went and played in Hong Kong.
Yes.
And then did you come right to Prague from Hong Kong with me, or was that a second year?
That was, oh boy, that was different. I think
it was different because you went from Prague to Poland with me also to play.
Yes, I went from Hong Kong to Australia. Remember, because I went
you
back.
Went back. I went, you went back.
I went back. Yep.
You had a crazy girlfriend.
I did, yes. Pray she's not listening to this. I don't think she will. That relationship was, I think, built on the excitement of our mutual sort of foreignness to each other. You know, I was American, she was Australian. There was like an excitement about each other there that was very surface level in a lot of ways. Now that sounds terrible, but it is kind of, that is sort of what happened.
Oh, if it's accurate, it's not terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. And that relationship ended on not the best note. Nothing happened when I returned. I mean, there was no sort of coming together or anything like that. It was just sort of over when it was over.
All right, so the Hong Kong trip. So, you know, I just listed off, you know, you went and played in Hong Kong with me. The following year, you went and played in Prague. You played on the Jagged Mountain team for the Memorial. Came and played with us in a hilarious weekend, you know, just bender of a weekend playing lacrosse in Poland. So those, you know, Australia is like that's a season. And then you played these three smaller trips with us. Like, I'd call those more of like tourist trips, you know, more of like just going out there to play and then kind of coming home. Like, what are your memories from like the, you know, the Hong Kong trip, the Poland trip, the Prague trip, playing in a memorial? Like, what are your takeaways
from those smaller tournaments?
Yeah. I mean, I can remember all, I love this. I live for this stuff, but like, what do you, you know, Tell me, tell me a story. Tell me something.
Let's see. So Hong Kong, that was my first time meeting Niles, meeting Tommy, meeting who else was on that? Reed, Barb.
Pete was there.
Pete. I think that was my first time because
Pete went down to Australia from there, right? With you.
That's right.
Yeah. Was that the year after?
No. That was the same year. So Pete and I had played together in Hong Kong, and then we became really good friends in Australia, actually. So that was that same year. Hong Kong, man, oh man, I don't know why it's sort of a blur in a lot of ways, but I remember the city was really unique. You know, it's kind of like what's Hong Kong like? It's like San Francisco in a lot of, like, it's so hilly. You know, there's skyscrapers on hills and there's a big body of water in the middle of the city. It just had a very San Francisco feel to it. Very high tech, bright lights, small little streets. I remember.
We played well too. That was, I mean, the off field stuff. It just kind of like, you know, we were kind of having fun the whole time. I just remember like a bunch of us packed in that room that, like, Matt paid for like a hotel room like on
yes
the streets
yes,
of yes. Lan Kwai Fao, and like Niles and I went gambling in Macau, and like, you know, we just kind of got in a, you know, pretty much every time there wasn't a game we were getting in trouble, but like on ferries and stuff. But I remember like we played well. I remember that was fun, like, you know, playing against Taiwan, playing against, like, I think we just destroyed the Chinese guys. I felt bad about that, but like that was a fun tournament. That was like that's the best tournament in Asia as far as I'm concerned. That was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun, and the competition was good. I remember that I was surprised by some of these like, you know, by the Taiwan team, for example. They were really like their foundational skills were top notch. You know,
they were just tiny, very
tiny, but so skilled, so sort of solid in their stick skills. I remember being, one memory I do have is just being completely blasted from behind, like carrying the ball, going to pass to you, I think, and then just being creamed, like just a total flagrant foul from behind, and feeling like my lungs had just detached from my chest cavity. Just being like, what just happened? That was just such a brutal hit that I mean, it was the hardest I had been hit, I think, ever.
I don't remember you getting hit, but I do remember, you know what, maybe I do remember you getting hit, because I remember, like, we did, like, our team at the end of that tournament was just out of gas. I mean, Tommy got hurt the first game. Like, he blew his ACL, like, day one. And
you yeah, know, that's right.
I mean, Alan was there. Pete, you know, I remember I was beat. You know, I was exhausted from that tournament. And, you know, I flew right from there to the Memorial to play another tournament. But, like, I remember just at the end of that one, I don't even know who we lost to. I know that Hong Kong won it and we didn't play in the championship. I know we played for like third, I think. I don't even remember, but it was that was a really, I don't know. I wanted to win that one. I thought we had the group to win. We had Niles and who was an absolute monster. So
yeah,
kind of just ran out of gas on offense.
You know, I remember feeling when I got there and we were practicing and we were all wearing our gear, and, you know, because we had all the same helmets, really nice helmets, the same gloves. We just really looked like a team. And I remember having the feeling like, how did this happen? who am I right now? Like, I am in some, I don't know where I am. I mean, I know where I was. I knew where I was, but I didn't really know where I was. And here I am playing lacrosse on this beautiful field next to this reservoir. And it's hot, and there's super all sorts hot. Of different teams around. It was such a sort of like, I kind of had to pinch myself that I was out there playing with these people. And you know, I had Charles was there, some of the Australia guys were there, and so it just felt like I was this international lacrosse player. It was like I was stepping into these shoes, and I was sort of enamored of who I was in a lot of ways. There was a sort of a romantic feeling that I felt about myself, like playing in this foreign country and, I don't know, making an impact. It was just very cool, very cool.
Oh, I remember that. I mean, they sent the equipment to our house to haul over.
Because
there were two of us flying from one location. So, like, we, you know, in theory had more bag allotment. And I remember we carried over a lot of the gloves and helmets. And that was, I remember that pretty fondly. That was pretty funny, shoving all those helmets and stuff into bags. And like your like my underwear and socks would go into a helmet. My shirts would go into another helmet. Like, you know, you were packing inside of helmets. I thought that was an entertaining one.
Yeah, and we were kind of weren't we both stressed that those bags were going to be too heavy, or that airport security was going to somehow see that we were, you know, ferrying these goods across country lines. I don't know.
You might have been stressed. I am an experienced smuggler. I was loving it. You know, you never put the thing 100% on the belt. You know, you should always leave off a good 3-4 inches of the bag. You know, especially with lacrosse bags. Like, you know, I haven't paid an oversized, you know, knock on wood here. I haven't paid oversized baggage in quite a while. But
you are seasoned.
Yeah. Oh, seasoned. Yeah. It's not like cheating, you know, it's a victimless crime, right? Well, so the Memorial/Poland trip.
Oh my gosh.
Is it not the best tournament in the world? So the Hong Kong Open is the best tournament in Asia. I guess the comparative cousin, I would say the significantly stronger cousin, the box lacrosse cousin in Europe, is the Ollie Hrebeski Memorial. And it is the best tournament in the world. Tell me about your experience playing with the Jagged Mountain Lacrosse Club.
Yeah, that was – so I had never played box lacrosse before. I think I just needed to fill a spot. I think they were down guys or something like that. I mean, I definitely wasn't recruited on behalf of my box skills, that's for sure. But that was the first time I remember feeling like a professional player, because you have the crowd size, you have just the sort of localized, intense environment, you know, that field, obviously it's enclosed. It's not like a big open outdoor field. You had the replay screen. I mean, it just felt that the facility itself was just so humbling in a lot of ways. I felt every time I stepped on that field, like I was a professional player or close to it, you know, like I had worked really hard to get there, even though I didn't, but, it was, and, you know, playing box lacrosse was also very humbling in the sense of it is a very different sport. You know, it's the same sport. It's still a stick and a ball and the pads are similar, but the way that your body, has to be in relationship to others and the way you use your body in box lacrosse is so different than outdoor lacrosse, and especially the way I play outdoor lacrosse, which is very sort of, I mean, I'm a lanky guy and I've always sort of depended on my speed and my quickness and sort of space to get by, whereas in box that's condensed. I mean you have to learn to operate in a smaller amount of space, and it's very difficult, or at least I found it very difficult, and the sticks, and it just made your stick skills that much more necessary to be really good and to be really sharp and in close. So it was a fantastic learning experience for me from that sense. And I played defense mostly. I wasn't an offensive guy, even though I think of myself as an offensive guy. I was like, they were like, okay, just hold your stick out and try not to let someone score a goal. So I was like, okay, I think I can do that.
That was my next question. It was like, did they let you play offense? Because you're a college attackman or, you know, offensive midfielder or whatever you did. I was an attackman in college, and I was immediately, when I started playing senior B lacrosse, box lacrosse, I was kicked out the back door. They're like, you know, you're a defenseman first. You have to learn how to play offense. And that was when I was 23. I'm now 31. And, you know, I'm still, they don't want to let me play offense. Like, you know, and now I'm playing in Radity and I'm playing with LCC. And because of a righty shortage, I am playing offense for the first time as like a 30, 31 year old man. Like, I have earned the right to play offense, and I'm loving it. Like, you know, it's almost like doing it all over again. I think that box lacrosse is interesting because, you know, the player who played, you know, the traditional, you know, all the way through, you know, college field lacrosse they get to reinvent themselves after college. You know, some people like to step in goal, right? Some people like to, you know, defense guys want to play offense. You know, Blaze Reardon is a field goalie, plays, you know, forward for the Wings. You know, like it's just like this. And I mean, he's always had good hands, but you get to do that other thing, and you know, you get to, you know, be good at other aspects that you didn't, you know, that don't exist in field lacrosse. And you know, I still love that part of it. I remember I gave you a red box lacrosse helmet. I'm like, you need to wear this. You go, why? And they're like, you know, I want to wear my field helmet. I was like, well, if you look like you play box lacrosse, like, it's going to go better for you. Like, people are going to think, and I think you had like a traditionally strung stick, like a box looking stick. I was like, oh yeah, you're good, man. Like, no one's going to try and go by you. Like, you look like you belong out here.
And it was a rude awakening. I mean, I think what allowed me to fare okay was the fact that I was fairly athletic. And so I think, and that's the thing too, it's like, if you're fairly athletic, you can play a position like defense and be okay, because, you know, there's not as much finesse and technical skill that is needed for offense. And I think that's kind of that was what my team's thinking was with me. It was like, this just, you know, he can run, he can push, he can do the things that a defensive player needs to do. But as far as offense goes, I mean, that's, again, the finesse and the stick skills. It was also really intimidating for me, because there were guys who I looked at and watched and thought, oh my gosh, that was incredible what he just did. And the footwork, and I mean, this, just the grace, I was sort of overwhelmed by the level of skill. And so I think that partly too had to do with it, with me just gravitating towards defense.
Have you, so like, ironically, you played for them back when you lived in Utah, like, and you had never lived in Colorado, to my knowledge. Now you live in Colorado, in Boulder, you know, close to the metropolitan, you know, center of Denver or of Colorado. Do you play with the Jagged Mountain guys at all now, or?
No, I don't. I wish I was better with that, but I moved here for grad school, and that took up all my time, as you can imagine. And so I didn't even really think about playing a sport, just because time was so precious for school. Because
you remember Preston from that team?
Yeah.
My brother actually has now like moved in with Preston, and I believe he plays with the Jagged Mountain guys. If you're ever looking to get your runs in, I'm sure they'd love to have you. And honestly, for me, selfishly, like, this whole small world thing, like, you know, we were talking before the call, like, I've played with a lot of people, a lot of different places, but you are one of the people I've played with probably the most places, like the most number of places that I've played with someone else. I have, you know, Niles might be up there. Pretty much the only place we didn't play together is like Israel and like Germany and like a couple other places in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, even that Poland trip, you know, like that. Do you remember the trains to Poland? Do you remember that fiasco?
Trains to Poland from Prague. Oh, kind of.
It was like you had to transfer three times. Like,
yeah,
it was,
yeah.
It was
yeah.
like a 3-hour train, 3.5-hour train. And like, it kept, like, you know, it stopped at the Polish border, and you had to run to the next train. And like, there was like 1 minute to change trains. And like, we were hauling a bunch of like equipment to like donate. And I just remember that was an absolute mess. It was like Mark Donahue, Toporowski, like, Rocho was playing deep, you know, a box goalie was playing defense for the first time in his life. And like, it was just a fun group. I remember that being just a fun, fun group. And we were terrible. Well, we weren't terrible. We were good, but we were having more fun than
the Muppets.
Yes, we were aptly named the Muppets.
The Muppets, yeah, and we were quite Muppety.
Yeah, like we beat like two national teams, and then like we, you know, had a night out, and like in the morning, like no one could handle. And I remember, do you remember the game that no one talks about? Like, can we talk about it or no?
Which one? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the game after the night out.
The game after the night out. We'll put it. I mean, we always say it's the game no one talks about. But Frankie and I talk about it all the time. We're pretty talented. You know, Toporowski can score wherever he wants. You know, I wasn't a bad player. You scored, you know, a million goals, and like we had good players, but we just could not figure it out. We couldn't pass and catch. I still have like a great photograph of I just tripped and fell down on the ground, and like I had the ball in my stick still, but I couldn't stand back up, and so I'm just like sitting on the ground looking for someone to pass to, and like it was just after I shaved my head too, like and I did a fundraiser to shave my head, so like I looked just ridiculous just sitting on the ground there, and like but we like this German team who like they could barely like figure out how to put their pads on, but they scored one goal against us. And we could not score a single goal, and we lost the game 1-0. And we called a timeout with like 5 minutes left. It's like, all right, boys, like who's gonna do it? Who's gonna run to the goal and score? And like no one put their hand up. It was just like, I can't do it. You can't do it. Yeah. He can't do it. It was. I don't think their goalie even made that many saves. I think I don't think we shot the ball. I think we just. But like.
Who was the team that was, and then there was just mountain people. They were dressed in black. They were huge. Do you remember this team? Bulgaria, maybe? No.
Oh, Latvia.
Latvia. I mean, like, identical players. I mean, they were all just like 6'4", built, and could run.
Yeah, and they make the joke they eat rocks. They're too poor, so they eat rocks. Like that's their thing is like soup made with rocks. That's the Latvian way. Actually, this past year we brought the Muppets team to Silesia Cup, and we had Nick Tintel, like a PLL MLL guy, and we went to second. We took second place. Like we played against that Latvian team like in the final, and I was like always saying like, man, if we had like Andrew Thompson come and like, you know, I was like a starting defenseman and Roach was a starting defenseman. He was using the shaft from his box lacrosse goalie stick. So like it was a party pole, like a short long stick. And he would just like, he would actually growl at players to kind of discourage them from going to the goal. He's a big guy, but he didn't know what he was doing. And he was like Googling how to play field lacrosse defense, like on the couch. but yeah, I was missing you this year. I wanted to run it back or that year. I wanted to run it back and win.
Man, that was fun.
But yeah. So, I mean, this podcast has gone longer than this. We're already in over an hour here. I tried to keep it under an hour, but I don't care. Like who says they need to be in under an hour? Like who's going to come, you know, calling, right? Tell us what you're doing now. And then I'll let you go.
Sure. So, I am in Boulder, Colorado now, just graduated from my master's program, which was, thank you. Yeah. I got a master's degree in eco psychology, which is like a total 360 away from finance or economics, which is what I majored in college. Eco-psychology, you know, bird's eye view is the study of the human-nature relationship, or how human nature has become estranged in a really dangerous way from the rest of nature. And so eco-psychology looks at ways to bridge the gap between sort of the human psyche and the world psyche. I recently got engaged, as you know.
Also, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. So a lot of changes on the horizon. I have plans to go and get a PhD in a very similar field. Not eco-psychology per se, but some sort of philosophical ecology sort of merging field. A lot of times with PhDs, you kind of pave your own way and make your own degree in a lot of ways. So I still have aspirations to do that. It's just a lot of money, a lot of time. And there's two things that I don't have a lot of at the moment. So not sure what the timeline is for that, but that's kind of me and my hopeful trajectory.
Cool. You will be my first, well, I mean, non-medical PhD friend, probably my only ever. It's the kind of the company I keep, but that's I know you've always been kind of into the holistic, you know, healing type, and I dig it. You know, I don't know much about it, but I know that when I have my, you know, when I had my back issues, I was like, all right, if I go to the doctor, you know, the guy said like, hey, you know, you got this wrong with you, you know, we'll cut you open. Can you come in next week? And I was like, no, like, I don't want that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are the ways I can fix it? And that was like a year and a half ago. I did fix it. You know, there was some mental aspect to it. There was a lot of dietary and mostly dietary and exercise, you know, behind it. But it was, I do view it as like a holistic journey, because I had to change a lot. Everything about my life had to be tweaked. And I thought that was,
yeah,
it was interesting. You know, 2020 has been an interesting year, but for me, it was like a whole year of, you know, it was a whole year off, and B, it was a whole year of, you know, changing tiny little things, which was, you know, mixed. It was a mixed bag. Some things I hated, some things I loved, some things have fallen off, but you know, the thing you're getting your master's and PhD in, like, I got a lot of respect for it. And you were kind of into that. You've always been into that stuff. Like,
yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, as you know, and as I think most people are aware of, is just the Western mode of thinking and, you know, the rampant materialism that sort of characterizes our existence here in the West is so unsustainable and so unprecedented in a lot of ways, and it's not going to allow us to flourish in any kind of way. And so I've always been interested in big ideas. I'm kind of an idea guy. I have this sort of flighty relationship to inspirational ways of looking at the world, and so I'm not surprised that I've entered into this eco-psychological worldview. But yeah, I kind of see, you know, things, technologies like carbon capture and regenerative agriculture, all these sort of tangible ways of helping the earth come back into rhythm. Those are necessary, but I don't think any kind of large, real, lasting change will happen without a shift in sort of the collective consciousness, which is, that's something, a term that people throw around a lot, but I just don't think it's going to be so much of a mechanical shift as it needs to be sort of a poetic, artistic shift in the way that we relate to the rest of nature. So I think sort of the aesthetic approach to the natural world is where I'm interested in, like, how do we see ourselves in a river, in a tree?
Yeah, it's not a come to Jesus moment. It's a come to Mother Earth moment. Like, you know, I'm on the same wavelength as you. Like, we've had conversations before, and you know, before we dive down this rabbit hole too much, and I
yeah,
can do a whole podcast on this alone, or you know, we can continue after we click stop the recording here. What's one book that would that you would recommend that you've either recently finished or just, you know, in your studies? What's one book that I should, you know, read now?
Oh my gosh! Well, I can so. One book. I'll do you one better. I'll give you a collection. So I've been reading a lot of fairy tales lately.
Wonderful.
And I can't tell you how important fairy tales are for an adult heart, an adult brain, and Anyway, there's a good, I don't know if you've heard of the Grimm brothers, but the Grimm brothers are like the sort of foremost fairy tale. So if you can find yourself an old Grimm's brothers original fairy tales copy somewhere, I would say that's, and read it before you go to bed every night. You'll just sort of come back into your child, the child within you, in such a sort of exhilarating way. Fairy tales or anything.
I'm into it. That will go over well with Czech wife too. She's big. Actually, the whole old European culture of they're big into their fairy tales. So
any fairy tales or legends. Because the West doesn't have, I mean, they don't have that. They don't have that tradition. And so a place like Europe will have pockets of it. And I think it's so important to keep alive.
All right. So Andrew Somps, my worldwide teammate, my valet, floor buddy, my Park City friend, my Australia buddy, thank you very much for joining me. I'm going to go read some fairy tales and I'm actually at the clubhouse right now, in Ratatine, so I might go throw a ball around here. I'll be out in Colorado this summer. We'll throw a ball around. I'll get you back out on the field, and we'll have to play against some other places. I actually don't think we've ever played together in America, have we?
I don't think so.
No, it's just funny, the way the world goes around, huh? All right. Anything you want to leave? Any listeners who last an hour and 16 minutes with? All good.
Thank you for this opportunity. It went a lot smoother than I thought it was going to go, and
I told you,
you're an excellent host and a gracious question asker, so I appreciate the time and look forward to being able to see you next time.
All right, I'll see you out there somewhere. See you later, buddy.
See you.